Welcome to the Gooder Podcast. I'm your host, Diana Freich. As partner and CMO of Retail Voodoo, an award-winning branding agency, I have met and worked with some of the most amazing women in the naturals industry. As such, I have decided to create the Gooder Podcast to interview these great people and subject matter experts and have them share their insights and expertise to help businesses all around the world become gooder. Today, I'm very excited to introduce our guest, Junia Rocha, co-founder and CMO of Brazzy Bites. Hello, welcome.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Of course. A little bit about Junia. She is the co-founder and CMO of Brazzy Bites, which she founded with her husband in 2010 in the hopes that Americans would come to love Brazilian cheese bread. And you'll have to tell me how to say this. Pão de queijo. I say that
so. Pão de queijo. Pão de queijo. You almost got it.
Pão de queijo, as much as they did. After appearing on ABC's Shark Tank, which I hope we get to hear about a little bit, in 2015, Brazzy Bites grew a passionate cult-like fan base, and in the years since have expanded to thousands of freezers and freezer sections nationwide. In her time at Brazzy Bites, Junia has gained experience in all areas of business, and all while remaining passionate about sharing their delicious creations with the world. Well, that was really fun. I am excited to hear a little about Brazzy Bites, the experience on Shark Tank. But before we get there, I really wanted to talk a little bit about how did you get there? So maybe you can tell us a little bit about your background. When did you come to the U.S.? And what was it about the U.S. at the time that was so exciting for you to make that move?
So I moved to the U.S. in 2005. It was right after I graduated from college. So I have a civil engineering degree, went to civil engineering school in Brazil, and then moved to the U.S. right after graduating. And it was an exciting move. When I moved to the U.S., I had been in the U.S. many times before, grew up in Brazil. Until, the end of my college years. And prior to that, in my teenage years, I was an exchange student. So I was one of those awkward foreigners that you see in high school that come from abroad. I was 16, lived in the suburbs of Chicago for 6 months. So I had already a pretty good foundation and understanding of American culture and American way of life. Knew a little bit what I was getting myself into, was excited, after you graduate from college, wanted to start, my career and just get to work as soon as possible. I always had the feeling and sort of like that American dream. American culture in Brazil is very strong. It was even stronger, 15, 20 years ago, of like the place of opportunity, the place that is modern, that is forward thinker, that all the innovation happened. So I was excited to come to a place where I could work hard and achieve my dreams.
When you say the American culture was strong, mm-hmm. what do you mean by that? Were there a lot of Americans there, or was there just a deep feeling that people understood what the culture was?
There is a lot, if you leave the U.S., you like Americans have an idea of what a perception of like exceptionalism, like what American culture is. In South America, it's real. Like there is this admiration for American culture. There is this sort of like that starts from like a young age when you're watching more like from movies, from music. There's a lot of access to the U.S. from Brazil and South America. There's, flights. It's easy to get to. There's a lot of South Americans in Florida. So there's this sort of like the U.S. is this amazing developed place where your dreams come true mentality. At least I grew up with that feeling. When you're young, your parents will save up and your first trip abroad is to Disney World in Florida.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so there's a sort of like the dream is to go to Disney World. And so that was part of my culture growing up.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's fun. Mm-hmm. So I just think, it's hard, as an American or any patriot, whatever country that you live in, to understand how people outside of your country see your culture. So that's a fun little insight there. I find it so intriguing, and maybe you could talk about this a little bit more, is how does somebody go, and this may not be how does somebody go from construction to food so much, is like, how did that happen or why did that happen? And is there anything from your construction days that you found to actually help you grow Brazzy Bites?
So I'll kind of walk you through how I even got into construction to begin with.
Okay.
Brazilian culture, similar to Asian culture, has a thing where if you're growing up like middle class, your parents says, your parents sit you down and tell you, hey, you can be anything you want, you can do anything you want, as long as you become an engineer, a lawyer, or a doctor. So there is like that. There's a lot of pressure in a society to go to those professions which are safe, right? Uh-huh. And so I was, and you need to select your career as at your entry point to college. So at that entry point, I was kind of call it pushed towards engineering because I wanted to go to business school. I knew that kind of my personality and my thought process and who I was eventually would end up in business. But then the culture said, no, business is not safe. Go be an engineer and then you can be going to business later if you choose, but you have engineering to fall back on. That's how I ended up going to engineering school. Then obviously when I moved to the US, I needed to work on my field. I was fresh off of college. I got a job. I got, luckily engineer is a wanted profession. So you can travel around the globe and get a job that will sustain you well. So I got a job. I start my career here in Portland as an engineer, as a project engineer in a large construction company. Wow. And begin develop my career in that field only because I had gone to college and that's what I needed to do. And so worked on that for 7 years. And it was, you know, it was a great starting point. I learned a lot. I was very green. I was fresh off of college, right? Mm-hmm. Needed to develop myself as a professional. And I was in a place where it was very high pressure. It was very high stakes. It was a big contractor that was building this multi-million dollar projects like airport, you know, wings and large condo towers. And so it was really high pressure. Typically like five of us building this $200 million building in 18 months. A lot of decisions and problem solving night and day. So here I am in my early 20s, just in that environment. So I begin to develop very quickly. And on top of that, there was a little bit of a twist because it's a male dominant industry. And here I am, this younger girl, very driven, working really hard. They very quickly saw me and said, well, let's kind of bring her into our presentations to win new projects because she has this energy, she's female, we will kind of get our diversity points with the developers.
Okay.
So, you know, lots of layers to uncover there.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it gave me a ton of exposure to a lot of strategic thinkers very early on. They put me in that room. So that was really cool. So set that aside. I learned a lot for 7 years. Getting to my late 20s, something is kind of that bug, you know, in the back of your head that from decade before were saying, this is not what I was meant to be doing. I needed to do something else. So, you know, it took kind of almost all of my 20s and working and learning and starting to build confidence to even listen to that voice in a way that I could make a move.
Mm-hmm.
Align with that, here comes this brilliant idea, which I had together with my husband. It's this sort of like passion for Brazil and like this amazing snack that is a staple in South American cuisine. And it's everywhere there. And we saw this product and we said, okay, Americans are missing out on experiencing this product in a way that is high quality in the best possible way and available in grocery stores where they purchase. And we saw this product here in the US market, very low scale, low quality, international markets, Portuguese language, it wasn't approachable.
Mm-hmm.
And so we also, like we had gotten married at that time, we went back to Brazil, had our wedding and realized that all of the Americans had gone, had had this like amazing, beautiful experience in Brazil. And they came back and all they could remember is how delicious the cheese bread was.
Oh, okay.
So we're like, hold on, there's something here. It's so memorable. People are flying from South America with flour in their luggage, wanting to recreate the cheese bread. All of these data points, right?
Yeah.
As it's just like ding, 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 ding. There's something special here. That's what drove me to make the leap from construction to food.
Wow. And was the idea of going into business with your husband, was that part of it, or was that a watch out for you, or what, like, or was that just like a no brainer because you guys are in sync? Or talk a little bit about that.
So parallel as I have my career as engineer, and I'm like, this is not where my future is. And I had this idea for the cheese bread. He was doing the same thing with his career. He was in industrial sales and he was doing well, had been doing that for 11 years. And he said, you know, there's something more. And so we both look at each other and we're like, there's something here. Let's try to do this together. Not unique, right? Husband and wives, friends, cousins, you name it. Very common in the entrepreneur space to have an idea like that. For us, it's been great. We're very different. We run different sides of the business. We have different perspectives, and worked really well together. 10 years in, still working together. Now more separate than ever because the company got quite a bit bigger.
Yeah.
But it's been an absolute pleasure, you know, and win. Yeah. It worked really well for us.
That's really great. Because, you know, it always goes one way or the other. So that's fantastic.
Absolutely. I think in the early days, don't get me wrong, there's been a lot of moments of friction, right? And you're not always willing to work all hours of the day together. So like there's days where I'm like, I can keep going longer. I can go all evening. And Cameron is a little bit more, I'm done. I need to switch gears. And so that's hard to separate. In the early days of growing the company, we felt like that was a huge advantage. We would say the following, like, people are now going their separate ways. They finish their workday, our workday continues. And we keep creating, we keep igniting ideas and inventing. And it was a sort of like, it was our passion. And so it never felt like work. And sort of like the weekends and all that good stuff. And also picking up when somebody can give a little bit more or they're less, you know, co-founder dynamic is challenging, you know?
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit, you know, we talked about kind of the idea of Brazzy Bites. Talk maybe a little bit about those first few months or years. Did it go quickly? Did it, you know, what was that path there? Did everything just kind of go, like everything just the boxes checked and things move forward, or was there a little bit of ebb and flow in the beginnings?
So what's that saying, like every overnight success has been in business for a decade trying to make it work? A lot of people discover us today and we're like, wow, this guy just came up, you know, we've been in business for 10 years. I will say this, we always had the vision. The vision that happened 10 years ago is the same that remains today, which is really awesome. Obviously, it's expanding to much bigger things, but the idea was we're going to sell Brazilian cheese bread to grocery stores in the U.S. in the frozen format. And we are going to get wide distribution because the only way they can make a viable business is if you get a lot of points of distribution, if you break through.
Yeah.
If you really, you know, to grow the brand, you know that very well.
Yeah.
You know, in all your work. So that vision remained, and we were highly focused always, you know, on, you know, for years, just cheese bread, just frozen, just retail. Where do we break through? Who is buying it? How do we replicate? And so we were very lean. We were very focused. We were very execution driven. Maybe that's from my years in construction, you know, that comes. It's all about getting it done. It's all about completing a text and moving on to the next thing to build a huge project, right? That applies so much in running a food company. We started small. We didn't have knowledge in the food industry, but very quickly become, you know, start acquiring knowledge. We decided that early on, looking at the market and everything that we had learned, even like really early, you know, was how do we open up this the distribution network for frozen, and realize that one of the gateways to growth was going to be Whole Foods Market for us at that time. Today still could be a gateway to growth for many brands, but there's more options today, right? You can go direct to consumer right away. You can do so many things, but with frozen, it was very limited. And places like conventional places 10 years ago weren't picking up natural brands like they are today.
Right.
It was kind of the beginning, but it wasn't like that. You had to go to Whole Foods. You had to go to natural and specialty as a way in. And then maybe Kroger, you know, Target wouldn't even touch it the way they do it today.
Oh, I know.
And so we were like, Whole Foods is the path forward to growing this brand, because then they can open up UNFI. We can go. So we had that strategy and we really executed on that. You know, we knocked on the one Whole Foods door. We got one store. Then we got Pacific Northwest, moved on to another region, another region, another region. It probably took us, many years. I would say Whole Foods was one of our first retailers. Just a couple years ago, we became global. Wow. That's how long it took to just kind of build and build and build. And today, Whole Foods, you know, sells over $1 million, $2 million of cheese bread alone a year in their network, and bringing more of our products and wanting us to make more for them. But we really thought that Whole Foods was a big player. So breakthrough for us, if you look at growth of the brand, identifying that strategy of Whole Foods frozen and opening up the distribution network so we can go get other accounts. And, you know, we grew through the natural channel. We went to Sprouts, kind of the very sort of like expected path of a frozen better for you brand, especially, you know, think about growing distribution like 7 years ago, slight different dynamic. Then we, you know, we got distribution at Costco, and very quickly in the same sort of call it week, it's like the week that all the magic happened, we went on Shark Tank.
Yes.
And then everything took off, right? Because now we're at Whole Foods, we are in the natural channel, we're at Costco, we go on Shark Tank, and boom, the brand takes off from there. And it changed everything.
Wow. So what is it that was in that journey there? Was there anything that when you look back, you can say that you were surprised? Something, I don't know if there was anything surprising, or like, I can't even believe that that thing happened, whether it was something operational or an opportunity or something.
You would be shocked by how many times, you wouldn't be shocked, but how many times we got rejected. Oh, for everything, and turned down by everyone, from fundraising side to distribution to consumers at first. I mean, the amount of rejection in the beginning was unbelievable. It was like consumers were like, what is this? I don't understand this product. To retailers saying, no, I already have one. To your surprise, like, there was another brand of Brazilian cheese bread in Portland selling product at New Seasons that we had to kind of compete against. To fundraisers, until like all up until the moment we went on Shark Tank, rejection across the board by every single, you know, angel investor, in food competition, you name it. We did so many of those and we got rejection after it. And when you look back, so many times out of this group and this group of brands, there were each one of these phases, like most of them are not even in business. And why are we in business? I mean, that's like so many layers, but when I look back in those rejections actually served us really well. They allowed us to really be focused on what was working. Like we encounter that, like, I'll give you an example of a food, like one of those incubators that you go in and you spend, you know, multiple weeks and you learn and you pitch and they end up writing you a check. Everybody would find us interesting, like the investors. They were like, well, this is tasty, this idea is compelling, but really I just want the 12 nut butter because I know that makes me feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it will be too hard to compete in frozen. It will be too hard to bringing an international product of like a global palette to the market, we start realizing that people like investors and like some people, they were not seeing what we were seeing. And it was all about how the consumers were reacting to the product. We kept kind of anchored into that. When we put the product in front of people at a food show, for example, very quickly, the line was the longest at our booth. Quickly, it was igniting this. I can't believe this is gluten-free. I've tasted this 10 years ago when I went to Brazil, and this brings back so many memories. My kids will love it. We start hearing all these things that actually created the brand target, you know, persona. Today is the kind of like all those things. And we're like, there's something special here, but we got to run like hell to drive demand. Otherwise, yeah, this thing is not going to go. It's a dance.
It is a dance. It's so interesting because I think I've heard this from, so many entrepreneurs just in the world that I've been playing in, but then also my close network of friends. And it really is being able to get up after each rejection and just keep going and take the learnings mm-hmm. from the rejection, or understanding what learnings to take from each rejection, keep moving forward. And I feel like the brands that win are the ones that are just tenacious enough to say, no, I'm going to keep going, and you're going to like me whether you want to or not.
Because you're only the people running the company, and in those stages are usually just the founders and nobody else are seeing everything.
Yeah.
And sometimes we can't quite articulate what we're seeing, or there is not enough tangible proof of what we're seeing yet. Mm-hmm. So then you get those rejections, and you got to be like, no, you're wrong. And it's hard to think that way. I only say that today, looking back. Because during the time when you get your rejection, you're like, oh my God, am I totally missing the mark on this idea?
Understood. I want to ask you one quick question about Shark Tank before I get into the kind of what we had gotten into a conversation with a few weeks ago. But on Shark Tank, everybody's familiar with Shark Tank. Everybody's at least watched one episode or a session of an episode. I would love to just kind of get your opinion when you were going in to Shark Tank, and what kind of talk about a little bit about how you were feeling and what you were hoping, and did you walk away with what you would hope for outside of the investment, or outside of like, did you walk away with any learnings that you would not have expected coming out of a Shark Tank episode?
So we went on Shark Tank. We signed up to go on Shark Tank. We had been in business for almost 5 years. So it was 2015. Mm-hmm. We founded the company in 2010, hit market in 11. So, product is out there for 3.5 years. We had already been through a lot of those, learnings and things. And we really felt like the show was a really great opportunity for us to expose the brand. We were fundraising at the time. And so the money was important. We felt like if we ended up getting a shark into our company, that would be great. It would add value. We wanted to get on TV and we wanted to tell our story. Why? We were growing this, mini category of Brazilian cheese bread that didn't exist. We were getting traction in the marketplace. The company was really small. We were under $1 million in revenue. And we realized that we needed to find a way to break through. Otherwise, it would be very hard to keep going and create a viable business. Really needed that exposure, that magic, right? So that's what Shark Tank was about. Similar to our strategy of Whole Foods, where we sort of like saw that, kind of that plan and laid out as like, this is the ticket to growth. Shark Tank was the next thing that we said, this is the ticket to exposure. We needed to scale that feeling of the events.
Yeah,
we were doing small events in the Northwest, and people, uh-huh. Oh my God, I'm falling in love with this. I can't believe this is gluten-free. I can't believe cheese bread is now in the U.S. available for me. All those things. We needed to scale that. So this show was the perfect opportunity to scale that. Think about it. You get in front of like 9 million viewers the week before Thanksgiving. It's cozy. It's warm. Like it's cold outside. A warm bread is exactly what you want. We prepared for that appearance more than we prepared for anything in our whole lives, because we realized everything was at stake. It was 5 years of working, grinding like mad, and all that we needed was a breakthrough. So it's high risk because we need the sharks to love this product. Otherwise, the consumers are looking at it and it's not going to do what we came here to do. And so every word, even if you watch our episode, it's like, oh, it looks seamless. You guys look relaxed. That's like in the back of hours and hours of preparation, hundreds of hours. Every word was calculated, everything, because we're like, this is so important. We practice so much, every detail, everything.
Wow.
I mean, we turn our living room into, we printed pictures of the heads of the sharks, and for like weeks we walked in front of them because we wanted to feel relaxed in front of their face. Because mm-hmm. you don't see them before you pitch. You don't do it because they're recording one after another. Every hour there's a, you know, founders, because they're recording the whole season compressed. And so every hour you don't see anything, you just go in. And so we were like, how do we make ourselves go in and be relaxed and be as confident as possible? And so it was an amazing experience because I believe we prepped so much. We put everything that we could, you know, on the line for the show. It really materialized that way. You know, the sharks took a bite. They loved the product. They closed their eyes. There's images of, you know, Mark Cuban and Lori saying, I can't believe this is gluten-free. This is amazing. And then we got multiple offers. That created just the demand that we needed.
Wow.
Well, you know, 9 million people watch this show. Thanksgiving timeframe, they go crazy. You know, we sell out nationwide within 2 days. This is very hard to do when you're only selling in retail.
Yes.
You know, it's easy to do when you have a site and everybody goes shop when they're on TV. When you're asking people to get in their car, drive to the store, yes. Free grocery delivery days.
Yeah.
And people did. And then, you know, a week later, we sold out the distributors and then we sold out Costco. And it became this crazy frenzy that we, you know, have been kind of building ever since.
Oh, my goodness.
It was amazing.
Wow.
Love the show.
Yeah, it's it feels intense, you know, at least when I've watched the show, there feels like, and I'm sure that has to do with how they film and the cuts and everything like that. Are they an intense group of people? I'm just curious.
Well, it feels intense because there is the intensity of the entrepreneur going and saying and thinking like this is a once in a lifetime opportunity, because it is, because it's like American Idol, just to be there. You're just already kind of, you know, eliminated hundreds of people. And then there is a sort of like the nature of being television and being like, they want to create drama. They compress like a 40-minute recording into 13. So they're really going to want to show the most like dramatic, you know, so it's TV. So it's engaging. So it's fun for the viewer.
Okay.
So there's that piece. As long as you kind of understand that, you know, I think that's okay. I mean, that you sign up for that. Like you're like, I'm going on TV and it's a TV show.
Yeah, it's a TV show. But I think even those of us that have been on TV shows or have done any kind of video recording, sometimes you forget, oh, yeah, that's right. There's hours of this stuff and they've just chopped it up into the most exciting bits. And that's why there's the energy behind the conversations.
Yes, absolutely. It's not like that the whole time, right? But they're just like editing the perfect dramatic pieces.
Well, it seems like your last 10, 11, 12 years have been pretty exciting. Like the growth and between the rejection and the growth and the demand and like all of that, it just makes for exciting times. One of the things that we talked about, and I'm going to now start to change to this topic that you and I had discussed. And one of the things that you said, you know, I feel like I'm seeing, we're going to kind of step away from, here's Junia, she's co-founder, CEO. And the thing that you had said to me is like, I feel like there's a gap of women, or there's an outage of women once you get certain way up the threshold at a conservative, or not conservative, but as you're coming up the professional ladder. And for some reason, there's like women suddenly disappear at the VP level, C-suite level. And as we got to talking, you felt like, or maybe we came to this conclusion together that there might be something in the way that Brazilian society versus American society supports women and families in particular in encouraging people not just to become engineers and doctors, but to just continue to grow. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that here. So I think the question I want to say is, you know, can you share with us how you feel like is the Brazilian culture, how different is it than the American culture in regards to, we could talk about women in and careers, or we could just talk about careers in general.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, in our conversation, I mentioned to you, like, recently, as I did, you know, we did a deal with private equity, and I get to be in the boardroom, and I get to be, a decision maker in our company. I realized again that I was back to almost like the construction fabric of the room,
yeah,
of just me as a female. And I start kind of thinking about that. And at the same time, I had my first son 3 years ago, and have, you know, several friends that had their have kids now. And I start seeing how they change their careers post kids. And then recently start thinking about, like, why do I have a certain approach to it versus other, you know, American moms, businesswomen. So I'll kind of like speak to, I think that our conversation kind of went to sort of like the raising family and the impact. And one of the things that I noticed about how sort of like my mindset is when I grew up in Brazil. So I grew up in the 80s. It was the first generation where, you know, my mom was a school teacher. My dad was a business owner and engineer as well. So she was very much like a mom, stay-at-home mom versus teacher, kind of had that sort of mentality. My generation, call it like people born in like mid-70s to the 90s, it's almost like they're trying to overcompensate a little bit and just give us opportunities. So in Brazilian culture, there's a sort of a different dynamic of how you structure your day and how you do like chores and how you do like work so you can have like free time to develop skill sets. And whether you're middle class or any, you know, socioeconomic class, it's very similar. So that's not, you know, unique to a certain class, but you're sort of encouraged to free up time, you know, from chores or anything else, from cooking, to focus on developing your skill set, to develop professionally. So when in the environment that I grew up in, I'm not saying that's like positive or negative, it just was.
Yeah.
We were never like this came for boys and girls. We never like learned how to cook. We never even learned how to clean. We were just career focused and sports focused.
Interesting.
A lot more time. And we were encouraged, you know, to just develop skill sets. And we were always encouraged, like, as girls to, Brazil is a very progressive country in that way. People might not know, but, you know, there's already been a female president. Mm-hmm. There are female leaders in many pieces of the culture, lots of issues, but it is developed that way. Where, you know, there's female CEOs. So I grew up in that environment, seeing that there's female CEOs, there's female business owners, females are doctors, lawyers, engineers, they're leading things. So that was the example that was set to me. And then it's a bit reversed from American culture, where when you have kids, it's looking down upon if you're a stay-at-home mom. It's a little bit France. I've read many books when I was, you know, pregnant with my son, has a little bit that way, which is not necessarily good. Again, I'm not endorsing this, but it's like, how fast can you bounce back? How fast can you get back in your career, in your body, in your shape, right? Okay, so that's kind of the ingrained mindset. I moved to the US. I start my career. That never impacts me. I don't have a kid, you know, for many years in my career. So I'm growing. Suddenly I have a kid. And I start to realize that a lot of my friends who have kids, suddenly I'm the only one structuring a whole layer of support around me so I could keep my career going at the same pace, because it was my choice. I love what I do. I love running the company. The company is at a really fun stage that I want to be a part of. But at the same time, it's time for me to grow my family. I wanted to do that as well. So I kind of like start looking at both things and I was like, okay, how am I going to keep that going? I had to structure my life and organize my life to get help. So my son had support and he had a structure that allowed me to work full time, that allowed me to stay in my trajectory as, you know, a C-suite executive in my company. So it got me thinking about it. And then suddenly I'm seeing a bunch of friends like take a step back and being so embarrassed about seeking help at home, whether it's with cleaning, with grocery shopping, with childcare, those things that really are important to keep our family lives going. They take up a lot of time.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to do it all. It's not possible to do it all. So I'm still developing perspective on that because it was most recently. And, you know, here there's so much pressure to be the perfect mom, to be a stay-at-home mom.
Yeah.
A friend of mine I was sharing my perspective with her. I said, you know, at the end of the day, I thought about what makes me really happy. And I love my job. I love running this company. This company is a very special time right now that might not be here for me 4 years from now.
Right.
You know, and I don't want to step away for a year or two and miss out on this amazing, you know, story and this work that I'm just like, I keep growing and growing. And then I was sharing with, you know, a friend and she was struggling with pressures from family. Well, now you stay home. Now you do less at work. But what is it that you want? And how do you empower yourself to structure your life to do what you want?
Yeah, I think that's where you and I were talking a little bit because I'm there as well. It's the, I feel guilty for wanting, I call it Alice from the Brady Bunch. I want an Alice, like in the back of my brain, in the back of my head. I'd like somebody to just run the day to day, but I feel guilty about wanting that and asking that because we live in a culture where I shouldn't be checking out like that, that I, you know, so I can understand that. When you're thinking about that, are there any learnings or do you have any perspective on for women or families or employers? Even employers, are there things that employers can do to help women and families? Because sometimes men are the ones that are carrying the brunt. It's like sometimes the mom is doing something else, or even you might have same-sex couples. So I don't want to like exclude anybody, but somebody is bearing the brunt of the day-to-day. Is there advice that you would give employers, or do you feel like it's more on the person to kind of feel comfortable with the ask? Do you have an opinion there?
I mean, obviously the U.S. has major issues with maternity and paternity leave. Right? And family support. There's a ton that needs to change to really support families like that. I mean, where do we start, right? From leave to, you know, flexible schedules. But I do want to recognize that when you're running a small business, some of these things might not be possible. Like our company, like up until like 2 years ago, couldn't afford, you know, to give a leave or to give flexible schedule. I think now in the COVID era, we're all learning that we can have a little bit more flexibility and the companies will still function. That was, I think, a good thing that's coming out of this pandemic. We all learned to work remote. I was very hesitant with our team, you know, going remote, but I think everybody has proven that the company still runs and still works, and that's how it is. That piece can help parents quite a bit. I think there's a ton that companies need to do.
Do you feel that kind of to step back a little bit in this whole, like women are changing their roles or whoever is running the family is like changing the roles? You mentioned you felt people were stepping away, shying away from leadership roles because of that. Do you feel that that's true? And is there really a way that a company can support somebody who maybe is really talented and that you would want to foster and nurture that? Is there anything that can be done if you're a smaller company, so, is probably what I'm thinking.
It's probably, yeah. So that's a tough one. Because if you think about it, sort of like you're going, if you're competing for a role and you're saying to an employer, one person is saying like, hey, I can be available at all times.
Yeah.
I can work full time.
Yeah.
I'm here for you. And the other person says, hey, I need this really flexible schedule. Yeah. I want to work part time. That is when you get into a situation like, okay, then this person is going to get, you know, the higher role and you come lower.
Yeah.
It is just the nature of how businesses are run. My point is, if you want to achieve that, you know, higher role and you're a female or you're in charge of the household and you have those responsibilities, it is okay to get help to do that.
Yep.
You will not be able to do it all. You can, it's just acknowledging and structuring your week and your life to get support. Oh, but it costs money. Like Americans love this, which is very different than Brazil. Well, if I can do my yard on a Saturday and spend 8 hours doing my yard work, why am I going to pay somebody to do it? Because you're spending 8 hours on your Saturday doing yard work. That is why.
Yeah. Yes.
If I can clean all of my, because you can, you actually can, you're capable of doing everything.
Yes.
Right? You're capable of doing all of the grocery shopping, of all the yard work, of all the cleaning. Yes. So it's like that mentality. I'm capable versus like, what am I doing with this time? Everything is a trade-off and you're going to have to pay for it. But sometimes it's a fraction of it. Like for me to just, for example, pay a nanny or have more structure at home in terms of taking care of the household allows me to stay the course of my career. And while like I'm taking a financial hit for a few years when my son is very young, I believe that I will recover that tenfold as I keep progressing in my career and don't fully stop. Again, my choice because I love what I do, right? And I think that just the problem that I'm seeing is when you want to keep going in your career, but you don't give yourself permission to get help and structure your life. That's for that type of person that I'm speaking.
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah, I agree. And I almost want to say, and tell me if you think I'm crazy about this, but I almost want to say that even still the language that we're using is like, I'm going to take the financial hit or I'm going to ask for the help is actually, if we can start going that this is the family asking for help. This is the family that's taking the hit, so to speak, however you want to look at it. And I think that if we can start looking at this as rather than my responsibility, but the family's responsibility, then we already start stretching into that help mode because now it's more than just me in the role. How do you feel about that?
Agreed. Couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
I guess I'm saying like me a lot, but in our household, it's definitely the duo.
Yes.
You know, making those decisions together.
Yeah.
And if either one of us wanted to slow down for whatever reason, but we both happen to be working full time and enjoying what we do and thinking that this is what we want to do.
Yeah.
And so in order to do so, the family had to make that decision together and create this structure around it.
Yeah. I like that. Cause that already starts us thinking outside of me or outside of why I have to do this. Okay. Mm-hmm. I also found it really interesting when you were talking about, how in Brazil that, you know, just going back to how in Brazil, the emphasis was on really just career and sports and, you know, and that you've got a whole community supporting you in growing you, who you're going to become and whatever it is that you want to be. So I like that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk a little bit about just kind of the industry. And maybe you can talk a little bit about what are you excited about in food manufacturing right now? And it could be with your specific product, but it could be anything. It could be supply chain. It could be interesting new product or ingredients. Is there anything that you're excited to watch right now?
What excites me the most about our industry, I mean, I love the natural foods industry. You know, I love food and like how much that fuels your body and makes everything like you're healthier. It makes you function better. It's like, huge believer in natural foods. and love everything. Like one of the, my favorite things about this industry is the passion, these founders that are just like, won't stop, won't give up on creating and cleaning, you know, ingredients and recreating products and cleaning label, the delicious creations that come on the market, and how creative and innovative the industry is. It's unbelievable. You know, there's so many founders, there's so many new companies coming up with the coolest products. Not all will survive, but the creativity is awesome. Like, you know, recently, for example, like we've been drinking LaCroix for years, and you know, LaCroix is a very innovative product. It moves you from soda to water. Mm-hmm. Very cool, very innovative. Recently, we upgraded to Spindrift. Now we go, you know, water with just a splash of real fruit. Like that is just like you think that there's no more market for bubbly water. You know, here comes Spindrift, a whole new creation. That is so cool to watch, you know. Mm-hmm. In our company right now, we went through like a huge innovation process to go into the breakfast category. Mm-hmm. And we started looking at everything in the breakfast, how people eat breakfast, who eats frozen breakfast. And, you know, have a really cool innovation coming out the pipeline this fall that is really exciting to me. We started eating, you know, the product here in the office and just couldn't get enough. That's when you know you're ready and to push the product out. But, you know, this industry is just relentless and creative and so innovative, and people are really passionate and they are just willing to do what we did, is just face tremendous amount of rejection because their product makes sense. Mm-hmm. And the consumer eventually is going to, you know, want the product. It's a great industry to be in. Much cooler than construction, I'll tell you that much.
I think it would depend. I'm a huge fan of like Zaha Hadid, and had I ever had the opportunity to work on something like that, that'd be pretty amazing as well.
But that's true. No, it's fun over there too. I just, you know, food is very vibrant. It's changing. Yes. It's competitive. It's dynamic. Mm-hmm. It's a great industry.
Yes, I will agree with that. If you could reach back in time, is there anything, any kind of advice that you would give yourself about maybe take something a little bit less seriously or pay more attention someplace else, anything like that?
If I could look back and like what would I tell myself, I would say, you know, trust your gut. Everything will be okay. Everything will work out the way it is going to work out. There was so much stress, you know, in those beginning years, until we kind of broke through and created a viable business, it's hard to trust your gut. Like, you know, your gut is telling you to go somewhere, but you're getting so much rejection. The path, there's so much hardship, and it's hard to trust. I would say that's okay. Trust your gut. That's okay.
And maybe, I think you may have already shared something earlier, but I'll ask you again anyways. Is there anything fun or interesting about the Brazilian culture around food that maybe Americans aren't aware of that would be just kind of fun to know? I don't know if it influenced Brazy Bites or not, but.
A couple of things I'll share that's interesting about Brazilian culture. Brazilians are very social, right? So they're always gathering. They're always, families are always together. You'll probably see your extended family every weekend for a meal. One kind of like interesting thing is, and sort of like that ignited also as part of our founding story in Brazil, a family will typically always have frozen cheese bread at home waiting for a guest to pop in.
Really? Okay.
So if you think about like, you always maybe have chips, you know,
yes,
in your pantry, or you have a couple things, you have some cheese, who knows what's going to come at you. In Brazil, cheese bread is always a staple in your freezer,
really?
Waiting for a visitor, for unexpected family to drop by. You're going to pop it in the oven 20 minutes later. It's delicious. It's got a beautiful smell in your house. And then you're sitting at a table just talking and gathering. And
that's,
so, yeah.
That's fun.
Mm-hmm.
Is it common for families to live close in proximity in Brazil? Or
very much so. Very much so. And it's still like of Latin culture. Mm-hmm. Now that the world is like more global, it's shifting just so slightly, mm-hmm. but still it's more common there to be born and raised somewhere, to get married in your community, to raise your kids, to have, you know, the grandparents close to the grandkids, very much so. Mm-hmm. You're usually going to stay. Now in the major cities there, there's a bit more moves with professionals like Rio, São Paulo, some, you know, key cities there, but much more common that you're going to stay put and you're going to stay close than here.
So we're coming up here on the end. I have a couple more questions for you. These are always my fun ones. Talk a little bit about what kind of rituals you have in place right now to keep yourself positive and focused. And this might be something you've been doing for years, or maybe it's something new.
So I'll share something that we did for during the early days of Razzy Bites that serves us well to this day. Like during those years of like the things that go well, we're knocking on doors, we're getting so many no's before we got a yes. We would kind of end the day and always, you know, say three things we're grateful for and try to focus on like maybe the one positive thing that happened that day. So what that did for us, and this is me and Cameron in our exercise at home, like end of the day, you know, had a tough day. It's amazing how that can just like change your brain chemistry and how you start just being grateful mm-hmm. for things and you start to just like see everything positive. It can be very small. It can be like the weather or, you know, a nice walk or like something about your home, like Portland. So many great things about Portland. You can, you know, just have a big list. Suddenly we forget about all the tough stuff that are going on, you know, and like in our business, we always say like, we can get 100 no's, but if we got one yes, we focus on that one yes. Mm-hmm. And that's how we build this company. And that's how we kind of think about our lives. You know, we, even when things are challenging, we say, but there's all these things that are great. You know, there's all these things that are opportunity. There's, you know, we're healthy. You can focus on your health. You can focus on the fact that you have a job or, you know, that you connected with a friend. So I think that that's so powerful, you know, and it's not a tough exercise to do. No. It takes practice, but it starts to shift your thinking. You start become grateful for all these little things, mm-hmm. for the tea you're drinking. Like you start very small, right? Mm-hmm. For this conversation you and I are having, mm-hmm. for this opportunity to talk about these things, like mm-hmm. all those little things. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly you become a highly grateful person. And when you are highly grateful, you're just like go through life with such more ease and grace and trust.
That's a t-shirt.
It helps. It is a t-shirt.
I always like to kind of end conversations with my guests with this one particular question when I can. Tell us a little bit about an interesting travel or business meeting or worst business trip that you're willing to share.
You know, I always had, I ran sales for the company for many years, uh-huh. and I was traveling around the country like every week, you know, pitching the product to retailers and stuff. My biggest fear was always to like get on the ground somewhere, like travel all the way to the East Coast, get on the ground and have the buyer completely forget that they had a meeting with you.
Oh no.
That never happened to me, actually. I was so fearful of this, you know, potential problem that I was always emailing ahead and like, I'm coming. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but one of my most memorable trips was when we were doing so much and all over the place. And I happened to have like a UNFI trade show that was in Portland in the convention center for 2 days. And I couldn't get anyone to work the show. I had to be there with an assistant. Yes. The next day, I had nailed a meeting with Harris Teeter.
Oh my goodness.
Like at 8 a.m., you know, in I think it's South Carolina, I believe. And it, you know, across the country, we're in Portland, Oregon. And I'm like, I'm the only person who has to be in that meeting. That meeting cannot move. So I remember working 2 days of the UNFI show nonstop. You know, you're talking to buyers, you're pitching, you're doing this. From the convention center, going straight to the airport, taking an overnight flight to the East Coast, immediately taking an Uber, Starbucks, you know, coffee, you know, breakfast wrap, going straight to the hair studio. That was pretty memorable because it's not how you'd want to do it. It's not how you want to be rested. You want to be clear headed. Yes. You don't want to take an overnight flight. But I remember that really well. I actually ended up having a decent meeting, got placement, was successful. Don't know how. Don't remember what I said in that meeting. Just, you know, the pitch becomes so seamless. But I ended up finishing the meeting, going back to the airport and coming back to Portland. So it was the first, only time I went to the East Coast and never got a hotel room. I won't recommend this. I won't recommend this. But it was a very memorable trip.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, that's fun. It's not fun in the moment, but it pushed what that tells me is like,
what am I capable of? Like, it just, I pushed myself physically and learned that there was kind of hit a wall there, but got it done.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Before we wrap it up, if people want to reach out to you, how would you like them to connect with you? Would you prefer that on LinkedIn, or do you have a different way you'd like people to connect with you?
LinkedIn is great for the network professionals. Yeah, it's the best place to find me.
Okay, great. And there's just one Jania Rocha, correct?
I believe so.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I hope that you had fun. I hope that was kind of
fun. I did.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
This episode is sponsored by Retail Voodoo, a creative marketing firm specializing in growing, fixing, and reinventing brands in the food, beverage, wellness, and fitness industries. If your Naturals brand is in need of positioning, package design, or marketing activation, we're here to help. You can find more information at retail-voodoo.com. And so there you go. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you so much for hanging out with us today. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to this channel and share with your network. Until next time, be well and do gooder.